Would you follow a king to the Black Fortress?
Now I know you're a lunatic. I wouldn't follow my own father to the Black Fortress.
If he could find it.
Not that he'd be foolish enough to do such a thing.
Is it foolish to defend your world? Or to fight for your homes and families? If the invader is conquer, you'll be slaves of the rest of us.
Noble sentiments, but we fight for profit. You know what I mean?
But the profit's freedom. And fame.
Freedom? Well, we have it. And fame. Yeah, it's an empty purse. Count it. Go broke. Eat it. Go hungry. Seek it and go mad.
This it was given me to know, that many worlds have been enslaved by the beast and his army, the slayers. And this too was given me to know, that the beast would come to our world, the world of Krull, and his black fortress would be seen in the land, that the smoke of burning villages would darken the sky and the cries of the dying echo through deserted valleys. But one thing I cannot know, whether the prophecy be true, that a girl of ancient name shall become queen, that she shall choose a king, and that together they shall rule our world, and that their son shall rule the galaxy.
Welcome to Exposition Street, celebrating geek movies in all their splendiferous glory, and a presentation of Prismatic Tsunami. My name is Eric. Thank you very much for joining us for this episode, our 65th episode of this series. We're really excited to be here today, and we've got a great movie in store for you. This one's been a long time coming. It's been on the list for a while, and we finally had a chance to sneak it in there while it's still available to watch. We had to go to HBO Max for it, but it was worth it. Before we get into it, once again, if you would like to recommend anything for the show, any movies you'd like us to discuss, please feel free to drop us a line. Feedback@prismatictsunami.com is about the best way to do that. Or you can drop in on our Discord server and join the conversation there. Let us know what you think. And anything else you want to mention about the show or about previous episodes, definitely bring it up. We'd love to hear from you. Getting things started for today, going to go ahead and introduce the panel. What do I got over here? He may not have pioneered the trick of disappearing at dawn and showing up somewhere completely different, but it wasn't for lack of trying. It's Richard.
Yeah, I dropped my glaive in the lava again.
It's third time this week, man. Would it really have been so hard to give a dude a broken glass bowl or something that, you know, you might just have lying around to carry some life-saving sand past the Spider of Doom? It's Vanessa.
I mean, everyone has a broken glass bowl, right?
It's still a question. I guess that's fair. inside jokes, man. I gotta stop it. Tall in stature, narrow in power, wide in purpose, and he's obviously gonna give this stinker 5 stars. It's Jason, the Magnificent.
You've gotta be kidding me.
Yes, and finally, sugar balls, gumdrops, a Jedi craves not these things. What? You're damn right he's always got candy, it's the kid.
Don't you hate it when someone kills you and, like, your brain screams, burrows out of your face, and digs into the ground? I cannot count the number of times.
Hey, I'm writing the comedy here. this is Krull. We're watching Krull. K-U-R-L-L, Krull. I don't know if I say it very clearly. I try. I don't
say it. Is it possible to say it very clearly? Krull?
It's a weird word. It's a good one, though. I actually liked it as a name. It really stuck with me over the years, unfortunately, for everybody that's listening. So this movie came out. Go ahead.
I somehow missed the 5-6 times I'd seen this movie, that part that you just caught in the clip where they explain the name of the movie is the name of the world.
Yeah, it actually comes up in dialogue, I think, once as well. Maybe
weird.
Twice, but I didn't. Weird. I also didn't. No, I knew it, though. So I knew that I had caught it at some point, but I didn't remember it specifically where it came up or anything.
Is that what happens when it's not based on a book?
That could be. Was this not
Among
based
other
on
things.
That's interesting. Yeah. It's funny, back in the 80s when they tried to make original fantasy, it all was, you know, bad.
Original?
Yeah.
To be fair, when they try it now, it just gets canceled.
Attempt to D&D-fy Star Wars or something like that.
But at least they usually get 6 episodes for D&D-fy
Star
Wars.
So annoying, though.
came out on July 29th, 1983, went to number 4 at the box office with $5.4 million. Number one that week, by the way, was National Lampoon's Vacation, which made 8.3. Give you an idea of what the box office looked like at the time, because this was in a this was in the summer. It was a summer movie. Number two was Jaws 3D, and Return of the Jedi was still in the theaters at the time at number three.
Oh, so. I saw two of those.
Rated PG, runtime of 2 hours and 1 glorious minute. A prince and a fellowship of companions, if you can call it that, set out to rescue his bride from a fortress of alien invaders who have arrived on their home planet. Yeah, that pretty much sums it up.
That's a very long movie for the time.
Wasn't it?
But yeah, it seemed obscenely long.
I wonder how that stands up to other genre flicks of the time, because especially ones that were made for the theater. Like I remember Dune was pretty long, wasn't it? The 1980. I mean, of course, there were like 17 versions of it that weren't in the theater that were 8 hours longer. But I know that it was a long movie. And I mean, it was a couple years after this, but there was that trend, I think, at the time with stories, you know, fantastical stories, because you have to present so much in the story, right? You can't rely on a lot of audience assumptions because there's a whole world to describe, whether that's visually, hopefully usually visually, or through mountain of exposition. Either way, you got to have screen time for it. So I think that's a lot of it. Now, the other thing is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but fantasy movies, especially in the early to mid 80s, and sci-fi did this some, every one of them had to have enormous number of travel sequences or climbing sequences or something, and each one had to take 2 to 3 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
It was an eternity. It's like they took their cues from Tolkien, who wrote an entire middle book that was nothing but traveling and naming every blade of grass and rock that they passed.
Right.
And, you know, this is the blueprint, right? So we're making fantasy, so we got to make sure we get the travel in there. Even Harry freaking Potter did it in the end. You know, literally in the end. It was the last book. But I got a little exhausted, and I think that's where a lot of that time comes from, right? I mean, it's killing it. But not to say that it's boring or anything, just, you know.
That and watching the ship land and unland and land and unland.
What is it?
Unland 20, is 20 the best way to describe that.
What was it? Independence Day, 20 minutes of shadows flying across the landscape.
Right.
Directed by Peter Yates. Now, we hadn't seen much out of him pretty much ever. His big claim to fame other than this one was Bullet with Steve McQueen and Jacqueline Bisset, which was in the 60s. So, you know, he didn't do a lot else that I knew. He didn't have a ton of credits, actually, as a director. Written by Stanford Sherman, who wrote Some Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Batman stuff in the 60s for the Batman series, and was the writer on The Ice Pirates, one of Richard's favorites, which came out a year after this.
Heck yeah.
And music by James Horner, who was phenomenal. I don't know what happened. No, the music in this was actually really great. It just was. I think he was on methamphetamines or something. It was all way too much.
It was.
Anybody notice that? Is it just me?
It was reused later on. Like in other movies, right?
There was a lot of build, especially over the slow travel stuff, and it didn't seem to fit what was going on the screen.
In the entire movie, there was one kind of quiet, pretty sequence, kind of, compared to everything else. And that was when the horses were flying through the air.
Yes.
And that was it. And I was like, this is the most gorgeous piece of music ever. And yet, then it went right into horns blaring excitement again. Horns were blaring excitement when the dude was skulking in the woods looking past the trees. The horns were blaring excitement all the time. The themes were fantastic. I loved the music in this movie. I just didn't want to watch the movie with it. And that wasn't to say that it didn't fit the movie. Obviously, he had dailies or something to work with, because he cut with changes in the film. You know, the mood went up, the mood went down. I mean, that was there, but it was all turned up to 11. I mean, it was all Spinal Tapped out. No idea. No idea what was going on.
I love me some Spinal Tap.
And this was early-ish in Horner's career. I mean, he did Star Trek II the year before this, which was, by the way, a masterpiece as far as symphonies go. The entirety of the Wrath of Khan was a brilliant piece of composition, end to end. I have no qualms with that. He did Something Wicked This Way Comes the same year as this, which was a super spooky film.
That one gave me nightmares.
But this is the same guy that did Willow. I mean, Sneakers. We've seen him on the show a couple times. All good music.
Yeah.
Let's see. So that's them. And then we had Ken Marshall playing Colwyn. So did anybody recognize this guy? Just out of curiosity. I mean, I realize that this is the part where we get into this kind of weird. We're going all the way back to 83. So instead of getting just young up and coming talent, we get this mix of some young, maybe up and coming talent if they weren't in movies like this. And then older, you know, established people towards the twilight of their career, right? Who are taking a role. And this was expected to be a big deal. This was they spent a lot of money on this movie. It was, at the time, one of like the biggest budgets ever on a movie. And it absolutely bombed, by the way. I mean, I know I haven't gotten the
sure
numbers.
It
was absolutely bombed.
But he was the guy from Marco Polo, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that's what one of the things that got him this gig was, you know, the role in Marco Polo. I knew him from a couple other places after this, but it's funny, when I read that he had done them, I had that reaction that you guys often have when I say something that's so far out of place you don't know. And he did it to me twice. There was a movie that came out in 88 called Feds. Have you guys ever seen this?
Nope.
It had Rebecca De Mornay. I think it had Rebecca De Mornay in it. And
of course, that was the year I graduated high school. So,
but they were like federal. Yes. They weren't a Quantico. They were going to become federal agents, FBI agents. Was the whole thing.
And
it was kind
movie.
Of an action comedy. Yeah, it was great. He played Brent, the jock guy who was like the main problem, obstacle for them in the movie. And as soon as I saw that, I'm like, oh my God, that was only 5 years later and he looked like 20 years older. And then he played Eddington on Deep Space Nine. And I don't know if any of you guys are Deep Space Nine fans, but Eddington was a cool ass character, was in a lot of episodes later in the series. But to prepare for his role as Colwyn, he worked out constantly prior to principal photography. He had to, you know, do a bunch of training with writing and fencing and boxing and growing chest hair. He just really worked it.
He did have chest hair. Lots of chest
hair. Yeah, well, you know, this was after the 70s and they still thought that's what fantasy needed to look like, I think.
I mean, he also had circus pants the entire time that were horribly distracting.
His second biller was Lizette Anthony, I guess. Okay, so she played Lissa and she was pretty. I mean, she was... It's funny because her mouth didn't say damsel in distress, but her attitude, her approach to the entire character, did. the writing of the character did. But she's been in almost nothing. I mean, there wasn't really much of anything. I think she'd done a bunch of TV stuff. Nothing I knew. And she was only kind of in this because they dubbed her over. That wasn't her voice in the entire movie.
Oh.
The production company decided before the release in the States that they didn't want an English actress that nobody had heard of as much as they thought maybe they could use the voice of an American actress nobody had heard of.
So it wasn't sound issues. It was overdub.
Literally, yeah. She was dubbed in the final cut by a Lindsay Krause. I'd never heard of her either. I looked her up and didn't see anything about her. So
when I looked up Lizette, I did recognize her from a couple things.
Yeah, she was in Dracula, Dead and Loving It.
That
she
was
played
one
Lucy.
Of them.
That was fantastic, and her character in that was fantastic. Lucy was a fantastic character in that. She was vibrant and interesting and funny. What else did you see her in? I didn't see anything.
Angelique in the 1991 take of Dark Shadows.
The Dark Shadows remake, yeah. That's right. I did see that. I was like, okay. I never actually watched the show, but I saw her listed in the credits.
I did.
Like, okay. I'm not surprised. I tried to watch What We Do in the Shadows recently. That is a hard show to get into. Ugh.
I've been watching that with Brian. Brian loves it. I tolerate it.
It's background noise. It's not necessarily I need to focus on this show.
No, there's nothing to focus on. That
it's,
would drive
it's
you
got
crazy.
Some good moments. And I love Colin Robinson. He's hilarious.
He's the best character.
Some of the, I mean, the writing is funny, but the show is so dry and weird that it's really hard to invest myself in enough to want to watch another episode. So it's one of those things that's like, I've got half an hour to kill, you know?
Yeah, that's not unfair.
It's a weird combination of American comedy and British comedy, and it doesn't always jive.
No, it misses on some shots. Yeah, I'm going to definitely agree with you on that one.
Speaking of Dune, Freddie Jones
but
was in
Guillermo.
This.
Guillermo is amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No, you're good. Freddie Jones was in this. He played Ynir, the old man. He played Thufir Hawat in Dune, in the 84 Dune. Also the voice of Dalbin in The Black Cauldron, which is kind of cool. The voice of the old man, Pig Keeper. And Francesca Annis was the Widow of the Web, and she was Lady Jessica in Dune. So they were connected in this, but they weren't really in that, but they were in it together. So there you go. And she was fine. Alan Armstrong played Torkoal, who is actually one of my favorite characters in this. He's kind of funny because he's a face that we've seen a lot over the years, but not as anybody noteworthy. I mean, he had roles in Sleepy Hollow and The Mummy Returns and Van Helsing, and he was Uncle Garrow in Aragorn, unfortunately. He was in a lot of stuff that is familiar to me, but not somebody I've ever paid much attention to.
I mean, to be fair, Uncle Garrow isn't in much of the movie.
Well, that's good, right? I mean, good for Uncle Garrow.
That's the point. He's that guy in that movie.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, he's a pretty unique looking dude. I mean, you know, he's got a look. David Battley as Ergo, who is Mr. Turkentine in Willy Wonka. You guys might remember
him. Yeah, that's the only thing I recognized him from, and he was my favorite character in this movie.
Oh, God, he's so annoying. Ergo was annoying
that's
to
part
me
of
when
what
I was
made
a kid.
Him
that was his role, was to be annoying. But, and then...
And protect this kid.
And then Liam Neeson. played Keegan, one of his earliest roles. Not his earliest role for me, actually. Interestingly enough, he was Gawain in Excalibur a couple years before this. That's one we got to watch on the show sometime. Right. Again, I don't know if I ever want to go much back much further than Excalibur. It's still technically in the 80s, at least. But wow, that's going back there in terms of cinematography and look and feel and tone and all that shit. So, excuse me.
Yeah.
I have to say, I had no idea that Liam Neeson was in this. Not a clue until I saw his name in the closing credits.
Right?
Like,
he didn't look like himself, really.
Oh, I recognized him.
Where?
I did not.
Look, just
and like, then I wanted to go back and watch it again to see if I could figure out it was him, but... Yeah, I'm not watching it again.
Get on Google and
right now.
Get on Google and look at like Liam Neeson crawl, and you'll find some images, and you'll go, "Oh, he was him." You know,
he was the one that had the seven or eight wives.
Yeah, he had like the eight wives. Yeah, Keegan. Darkman wasn't until 1990, and that's the place where I think I really remember seeing him for the first time and knowing him as an actor and keeping him in my head after that.
Oh, I forgot he was in Darkman.
I loved that movie.
Yeah.
I loved that movie.
That movie was formative and interesting to me enough at the time that I remembered him from it when I saw him in other things, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So prior to that, he didn't do anything else that I would have known. Even though I watched this movie several times when I was a kid, and he wasn't one of the really dynamic characters, so wasn't one of the survivors at the end either.
No, it didn't even have any really good fight scenes.
And speaking of which, Robbie Coltrane was in this, and he was almost unrecognizable too. In fact, I knew he was in this. I watched most of the movie before I recognized him, and realized, oh, well, he's been there the whole time. They just hadn't shown a camera.
Another one of those things I recognized it right away, but I've seen a bunch of pictures of Robbie Coltrane.
He didn't do a lot in the 80s, a lot that we would know, and in the 90s, so he did a couple of Bond movies where he played, kind of a cool character, just a contact, And then he was in From Hell in 2001, the same year that Harry Potter's first movie came out. And he was the sergeant. He was the sergeant in From Hell, which was really good role. But I
need to rewatch that movie.
He was Rune in this, and his voice was dubbed too, so it wasn't really entirely
really,
Robbie Coltrane.
Still sounded kind of like him.
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, I can only hear Hagrid, so it's really hard anymore. $47 million at the box office, for the budget, at the box office. That would have been nice. $47 million budget, $5.4 million opening week, and $16.9 million was their total global take. So
they wish that was the box office. Yeah.
That was
one of the most expensively produced movies of its time. Was a commercial failure, panned by critics, even won a Stinker's Bad Movie Award for Worst Picture in 1983, and has a cult following. Okay, guys, full disclosure. I saw this movie many times when I was young. It was a cable darling. I loved this movie when I was a kid, but I came into it having not watched it in at least 20 years before this show. And I knew it was a terrible movie. I knew in my heart of hearts, that it was a cheesy early 80s fantasy flick that just happened to be on, HBO or something a lot. So I had just gotten to that point. There were a lot of movies back then that I really clung to, but this one was, it gets lumped in there with like Lady Hawk and even Time Bandits and stuff at that time that had the genre twisting to it.
Other movies I love.
Right. Watching this movie today, because I didn't get around to this till today because the last few weeks, as you guys know, have been just painful. Watching this movie today, I was impressed by a couple things, seriously impressed. One, this movie was a lot more coherent than I thought it was. There was a story here that I didn't even understand when I was a kid.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
One of the things I was going to say.
There are plot threads, and they are woven well.
Two, this movie was actually really pretty. It was still a product of its time. The costuming was phenomenal. You can tell where the money was spent. The effects were okay. They were the time. The costuming was really good.
Some of the effects. Were
the
okay.
Sets were really good. They built a ton of them. They had a bunch of sets for this. Some of them were,
That is one of the things that I'm going to be revisiting in the last segment because I had no idea that the sets were that amazing. Some of these sets were
huge sound stages.
Mind-boggling.
On this stuff. They built all this stuff. They did very little on location. And there was several hundred, cast and crew, several hundred people that created the look and feel of Kroll. 10 sound stages, 23 different sets for the movie. Even the fortress, Jonica walks in, I'm watching the last 20-25 minutes of the movie, and she's like, oh, I vaguely remember this film. Then she remembered why it was only vaguely at the end. It's like, oh, yeah, that wasn't worth remembering. But looking at the fortress as you're moving through it, and she's going, why does that look like they're inside a thing, a creature or something? Like, actually, now that you mention it, the aesthetic is definitely there. Why is that thing crumbling when he dies? Why is the fortress falling? You know what? It feels like it's kind of an extension of him. I think I'm good with it. There was a lot of stuff that just didn't need to be explained to me. And I was fine. Because one thing I didn't really want was more exposition in this, and I didn't want them feeling like they needed another travel scene, because the only travel scene I really loved was the one with the horses. But, and they had prettier. I mean, they had pretty vistas and stuff.
The fire mares.
Yeah, the fire mares. Which, I mean, I was like, they got, I got some stuff on that too. It's funny. Because there were like 16 Clydesdales that they pulled for that. See.
To be fair, the fire mares were only pretty at night. During the day, it was really bad green screen.
And John, that's when Jonica came in, was in when they were dealing with the horses. And of course, she being a horse person and, you know, grown up with them and stuff, she's like, nope, that won't work. No, you know what that horse would do? You know? Yeah, to the point where it's like they're flying through the air on hose of fire. And she's like, you know what? They won't do that either. Okay. So.
Yes, horses will not fly through the air on hose with fire. Yes,
got it. I'd actually be willing to take issue with her on some of that, at least, because they weren't horses. They were fire mares, which is a magical creature that just happens to look a lot like a Clydesdale.
They cross 1,000 leagues in a day.
And they're not like anything you found on Earth. Because the animals you saw 8, on the set that were exactly anything like you see on Earth were the ones that Ergo changed into. I got that right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I loved the puppy.
The puppy was cute.
I still say it was a stupid wish.
I still agree, but my God.
It was still a cute
changed
gesture.
Everything about that character for me.
It did.
He actually had some really great moments. I was so annoyed by him, and I think I was annoyed by him as a kid. He was like the character I didn't like, and you know, now I could appreciate the comedy of him better, but I was still annoyed. But he had some really good moments as a character, and I think because of the kind of actor he was able to polish those and still make it feel like the character wasn't really changing, you know, that's who he was underneath.
He had that classic Dr. Smith.
I found what I was looking for. So prior to the departure of the cast and the majority of the crew to Italy, 16 Clydesdale horses accompanied by 8 grooms were led into 3 large trailers and began a long overland trip from England to filming locations in the Abruzzi Mountains in central Italy. So before boarding the Dover ferry that would transport them to France, a passport for each horse had to be presented, which caused a sensation at the customs crossing point, as each passport contained 2 photos, one of a before makeup shot, one of an after makeup shot, because obviously they had no idea what stage they were going to be at that point.
Oh, wow.
That's fantastic.
That's fun.
So the area that I would be the most critical is the acting. Script. Somewhere between the two. The writing, acting. I've got some great clips that highlight exactly my issues. And actually, finding out that Lissa's voice was dubbed actually made one of those better for me, because it's even funnier. But Ken Marshall's performance physically, I thought, was great. I liked Colin, the way he carried to the character, the way the character, the physicality of the character. He was very present. I liked his smile. You know, he had a lot of charisma to him. It's funny to me because, again, watching the same actor play jerks in other shows, he doesn't.
Yeah.
But he fashioned his performance on Errol Flynn, performed all his own stunt work, including the mountain climbing thing, which was pretty dangerous. You know, the 2 or 3 minutes of mountain climbing.
That's impressive. You know? In costume. I was impressed.
I liked his costume, too. I don't know.
I did not.
Circus pants.
Oh,
I liked that. Oh, no, I loved the pants. I thought they were fun.
Circus pants.
I loved it.
I really liked the jerkin, the top he was wearing.
The top half was fine. The bottom half,
yeah, it's
not
funny
as much.
Another thing I completely forgot is I remembered the glaive from this, because that's like the big thing in the movie, you know, especially when you're a kid. But I'd completely forgotten that he wore like an amulet that had the symbol of it. I would never have gotten when I was young. I was like, oh, that's a symbol of something that's related to the kingdom, and that's really important because of some sort of, you know, just his magic weapon. Go get it. You know, it's all I cared about as a kid. And since that's what they do 5 minutes into the movie, that's fine. In December of 1988, Lizette Anthony told Playboy magazine that she detests this film, not only because her voice was dubbed over, but because people mistook her as weak and fragile like Princess Lyssa, and that she had to do little to do in it besides looking helpless while waiting to be rescued. She had several scenes of looking helpless while waiting to be rescued. She'd run back and forth looking helpless while waiting to be rescued. I thought she did it well.
Yeah.
To be fair, that's exactly what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. To be fair, Vanessa's going to defend this point. I can't wait. Bated breath. For 5 months. Oh no, I already covered that. According to special makeup designer Nick Maley, the special effects character of the Beast was, quote, the first self-contained animatronic suit. providing not only facial movement, but also lung, heart, and body fluid movement, all without a single external cable. And I thought,
really?
How amazing is that? And if they were going to go through all that trouble, why didn't they give us a single scene where we could see it worth a damn? You know,
Yeah, they should have definitely done more.
I mean,
was that.
Did they need the distance and fog to make it look real? Was it a suit that looked that fake? I mean,
yep.
If I were to take a guess, it probably didn't have legs because they didn't show anything below his waist.
Oh, that's probably fair. Yeah. Within weeks of the start of principal photography, the wardrobe department evolved into a showcase of over 100 different costumes, ranging from iridescent wedding gowns to tattered suede and leather riding apparel. Daggers, swords, crossbows, crates of emerald-colored stones, crystal hourglasses, and countless other items, many which defied classification, filled every shelf and corner of the prop rooms. I would have loved to steal some of those props. I think it would have been fun.
They would have turned to rocks.
Just when you think you're getting something valuable. I love the little laugh the old man gives at that with the seer. This goes good.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the wedding. It's interesting because the wedding sequence at the beginning of the movie is both a staging area for the film, and because they have like little things going on around it right before it, after it, and stuff. That's all part of letting you know what's important. That's where they deliver the stakes and everything. But the ceremony was kind of interesting and unique. Brief, but that's good. That's fine. And it had the carry through to the end of the movie in its really creative way.
Yeah. Chekhov's wedding fire magic.
Chekhov's fire of love.
Chekhov's wedding fire, yeah.
If they had not put that over the fireplace in the first act, we wouldn't have known. What'd you guys think though of the I love the kind of the ritual, the feel of it, the quasi medieval feudal kind of feel of things, but
it had a very Romeo and Juliet feel.
Well, and they were pushing that obviously with the dads, but they also weren't harping on it too hard.
Really hard.
Well, it didn't last.
They harped on it like, so much harder than they needed to.
But it lasted 2 minutes because then they were all like, you know, we don't have a choice in this. Damn it, they're gonna get married. Okay, let them get married. You know, I mean, Romeo and Juliet.
I renounce my kingdom.
Yeah,
they both gave up their kingdoms. I don't know why they did. It didn't make any sense to me. If they're both against the marriage in the first place, why can't they just be like, it's my kingdom, f*** all y'all.
I think that was exactly how you found out how serious the stakes in this were.
Yes, I agree. It was all about making sure.
It still annoyed me.
It was all about making sure that you understood how dire the situation was, that they were willing to go to this length despite. And that's why the Dow doth protest too much thing was going on, I think. Was the, you know, our world is in danger. The beast is going to do everything. Going to destroy our world. Destroy our world. That was the words that were used. I've got that like right here.
Corwin should have been here by now.
He may be forced to travel through the forests and the stone country. All the passes and roads are held by the slayers. Corwin may not get through.
That would please you.
I sent men to help. But I see no reason for an alliance with our ancient enemies.
Father, the invaders are destroying our world. We must have the alliance. Only if we're united do we stand a chance against them.
Yeah, invaders are destroying our world. Did they call them the Slayers? Is that what they kept calling them? It's interesting.
Yeah.
The Slayers.
But he has the mindset of, I see no reason for this alliance. And 5 minutes later, he's like, oh, okay, my kingdom's gone. It's yours.
But no, it wasn't yours. It was theirs. You know, we're in agreement on this. It's theirs. Because they're going to save the world. Again, King's doing what they got to do. Got to do. Gotta get in the politics game, headspace. Vanessa, come on.
He's such a stubborn king in the first, 5 minutes, and then he's just like, kingdom's yours, you're good. You totally know how to rule, because you made the decision to make the alliance. That totally means that you know what you're doing.
Now, I thought of you immediately, by the way, because I'm watching the opening of this movie, and when I remembered how much the love of the main characters was an important plot point in the film, I was assuming going in that they already had a relationship, and in fact, they were insisting on the marriage because they were actually in love and didn't want to go down that road because that would piss Dad off. Let's just remember that this is all a political thing. But in the scene where they first meet, they act like they haven't really met before. It appears I've chosen well.
No, I felt that was pretty clear.
And then and he, like, you know, 12 seconds later he kisses her and it ain't.
They've obviously had some sort of communication before. They may not have met face to face, but I think there is some sort of a connection, so I'm actually okay with it because they had a feel of a connection.
Okay. I can't argue with that because I feel like that was the way the story treated it. But the way that opening was written made me think that, oh, we went from nothing to this. Yeah. Just, you know, this, do you love me? Yes. It's like, oh, well, okay. Yeah, I met you 12 minutes ago, but I do. Yes, absolutely. You know, which, and I believe in that stuff. That's not the point. it shouldn't work that way in movies. But, you know, again, it made me wonder, you know, Vanessa, maybe you made a rush for me? No, okay, you're good. I'm good. We're all good.
It was rushed as far as, like, seeing each other, and it did feel like this is the first time we've actually seen each other, but it didn't feel like it was the first time they'd actually communicated.
And then the...
They had this plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, they obviously did. Yeah, you're right. And it was clear from their relationships with their dads, the discussions that were going on, that even if they didn't have much of a relationship prior, they had made the decision together to do this. So
yeah,
that suggests something, of course. But and you know, yep,
so I was on board. I'm going with it.
So here's what I was gonna share with you guys regarding Lissa anyway, whose voice wasn't her own, of course, so that helps. But there's a sequence immediately after that when the wedding is disrupted, which was so sad. You know, bad guys show up and lots of blaster fire. I don't know what were they shooting, like laser staves? It was a little unclear on what was going on there.
I have
no idea. I love the sci-fi fantasy mix, but you know, at least.
Yeah, blasters in the hilts of swords.
Is that what it was? I don't want to think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as soon as they got up close, they turned them around and swung them at people.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
It seemed to me in that very first scene that they only were able to fire one shot each, but later on in the movie they're clearly firing multiple shots, so I'm assuming I just misread
it. Might have just been the change in range, because it was a fairly like close together set. They might have fired one shot to like do as much damage as they could, and then they're close range, so they're gonna sword,
kind of like the equivalent of a bayonet on a rifle. You know, you shoot and then you get close and bayonet.
I would have questioned how useful it was, considering that they seem to have about as good an aim as stormtroopers on
right.
the average.
But, came out about the same time too.
But they completely overwhelmed that castle, and it looked like they had fewer numbers than the defenders. So I guess they're
pretty good. Well, I mean, Star Wars was clearly an influence here, not necessarily in great ways. The third Star Wars movie was in the theaters at the same time that this one was. So but this one I was going to talk about. Yeah, this right here. Now that I know her voice is completely in ADR, imagining her coming in is like, okay, no, can you enunciate the second syllable a little more? Colin! I'm just like, how many tries did they take? Wow. Yeah, but it is what it is.
Okay, I actually have to share just because the timing. I was watching a video on YouTube earlier today that had me just cracking up. Apparently, did any of you ever play the game Heavy Rain?
A little bit, but not a lot.
Heavy Rain, no. Was that...
Okay, spoilers
is
for Heavy
the,
Rain.
Is that the noir style one with the where you're responsible for the death of your own child, like in the opening act? Something like that. That was a depressing freaking game. I had a hard time with it.
It really was. There was a glitch in one of the endings of the game that I never knew about. I saw a video on it. Apparently, there's a scene where the kid dies and the dad runs up. And when you press the dialogue button, X button, he screams, "Sean!" Well, the glitch causes it to get stuck that. So for the rest of the game, every time you press the X button, he screams, "Sean!" So I watched this video of the entire final scene, and he's just through the entire thing, "Sean! Sean! Sean!" And I was dying.
Okay,
was so
that would make
funny.
That game so much better. Sorry. You could actually enjoy the story at that point and not be depressed. That's funny. In a really macabre way, I guess. Oh, my
God. Yeah, even after he gets shot and everyone runs away from him, you hear him in the background laying on the ground still screaming, "Sean!"
Just kind of continue with some clippage here. The glaive.
"You will need the power of the glaive.
The glaive is nothing but an ancient symbol. It doesn't really exist."
"It exists up there in a cave on the highest peak. The
Without the glaive, you'll never be able to reach Lissa.
I need weapons, not symbols.
Once the glaive was a very powerful weapon, it can be so again. But only in the hands of the right man. For only the right man can retrieve the glaive.
Am I that man?
I wish I knew.
I love the way he pronounces everything. Yeah, just the enunciation is so good. The glaive! Every time he says it, you know, it's like, you imagine the guys in like casual conversation. Yes, he went to get the glaive! And, you know, it came back down the mountain and good stuff.
To be fair, Ynir's entire, like, everything he said yes. had that gravitas.
Yes, yes. So good. Yeah, that's and that was kind of, again, part of the acting choices that were made here in this movie, which I guess, again, appropriate for the genre.
Okay. And I have to bring this up here because I had to bring it up somewhere, and this seems like the right time. For decades now, I've been asking this question. I'm sure I'm not the only one. In fact, I've heard it from some of you. Did the people who made this movie not realize that a glaive is, in fact, a pole arm?
They didn't play first edition. That's all I've got. I can't guess otherwise. The name had to come from somewhere. I mean, it just wasn't like a fancy sounding word.
It takes place on a different planet. They didn't know what a glaive was here.
Yeah, after all, their swords shot lasers out the back.
But everything else that they identify by names, they use the same names that we do.
Okay, I tried.
One thing.
I tried. On the plus side, they didn't have like glaives like we have anywhere, so...
No, I don't think I saw a single pole arm.
Neither did I.
Lots of staves, but and some really weirdly designed axes later on in the hands of the convicts. That was
fat and ugly.
There was a difference of opinion concerning a gooseberry pie. The man left it sitting on his windowsill. What did he expect?
Perhaps he expected to eat it.
For that rudeness, doubt. I think I'll turn him into a bat. Might teach you some manners to hang upside down for an hour or two.
The hill people lack the power to do harm.
We shall see about that, old man. We'll see about that. No, that's a recipe for hot fudge sauce. Oh, well, it'll have to be a goose. Fat and ugly.
Very fat, very ugly.
From that, you see what I could have done to you if I were a vengeful man.
I saw you trying to hold the straight face until the end there, Vanessa.
I
did not enjoy Ergo typically, but I did get a kick out of the fact that every time he tried to use his magic for some vindictive purpose, it did something kind of terrible to him. Every time he did that change for a good reason, an altruistic reason, it was a good choice. So, you know, he only got gooses and pigs when he was trying to turn
somebody else into something. To be fair, anytime he tried doing any spell, it just turned him into a thing. I'm going to turn you into a goose. A goose. I'm going to turn these guys into pigs.
I'm kind of curious that they didn't find some way to just, you know, make it work right for him in like the last act or something, you know, just something moderately funny.
They did. He turned into a tiger to protect the
kid. Yeah, because, you know, he had that in his back pocket the whole time. Jeez.
I mean, he had no reason to turn into a tiger before that.
Beast voice.
To go wherever you please within these walls. For this is the palace from which you will rule this world and countless others. You cannot escape me. You will be my queen.
Can I insert an ew here? So we're not going to marry the hot guy who's chasing you down. We're going to marry the monster who's like 10 stories tall and... monster.
To be fair, he can take any form he wants.
Any form he wants, yeah. But does that count as bestiality?
Only by name.
It depends on who you ask.
I was going to say the problem is he doesn't have a rose keeping him as a beast.
And that's probably for the best.
Does that mean that we couldn't have solved this entire problem just by hollering up old Gaston?
Gaston's
we didn't
on
need
Earth.
Another villain. Let's see.
Kill the beast!
What we needed was for the beast to have a library and a dining room.
He could have figured this out, right?
Talking yeah. furniture.
If he'd just taken 2 minutes to get to know the girl, he might have known how to trip or trigger, but he just was wanting to impose his will. You know,
and a romantic duet.
What a love triangle, right?
Couldn't hurt.
By the time Glaive Boy shows up, she's fallen for him, you know?
He could have approached her originally showing up as Colwyn, and pretended like he was rescuing her from himself and it probably would have worked better.
Motives were conquest and terror. I think this is more his style.
That's fair, but it also didn't work.
Creepypasta is how he rolls.
Even the shape-changing thing wasn't about deceit. You know, it was about power. You know, so he wasn't obviously the type of creature. His ego wasn't the type of thing that was about tricking somebody into accepting him or something. So, Cyclops. Yeah, this guy was interesting. We'll talk about him.
Hasn't he got a name?
His name is Rel. He visits the seer sometimes. He doesn't speak much.
So I've noticed, except to be sarcastic to people who wish to be friends.
Or jest with those who already are his friends.
My name is no jest, Beanpole. It's all very well to have a short name when you're 20 feet tall, but small people need large names to give them weight.
Your actions give you weight, my friend. I saw you save the boy from a spear.
Well, that's what friends are supposed to do for each other.
Quite so.
The dude was like 6'7" to start with, and then they put him in lifts. Pretty sure that prosthetic also blinded him. Did you guys notice?
Oh, it would have had to.
Anytime he just like reached to shake somebody's hand, he'd have to try like twice. Like, why would they keep that in there? You know, why not go ahead and do the take two or three times till he gets
because
it, well, it
Cyclopses
like
that, have very
have no
poor
depth perception.
That's actually really
it adds an element of authenticity.
Good point. I hadn't thought about that. I don't like thinking about that.
And also, it's possible that they had some way to see through the prosthetic. I mean, if you look at a picture of the guy, his eyes are further apart than
were. Right? I thought that was funny. Ironically, those the guy that got to play a Cyclops is one of those weird people that has fish eyes, you know, either side of his head. Wow.
I was gonna say for. Having poor depth perception, that guy's spear throwing game was on point.
Yeah, it was.
Well, Slayers, yeah. But, you know, that was also his hate on for Slayers game. Speaking of game.
Technically, I guess it would probably not be a spear. I think it would be more of a bident.
Do you guys remember that there was like a ton of spin-off like video games and board games and card games, all kinds of stuff out of this? There's a lot of merchandise.
Unfortunately, yes.
Do you? I remember I remember it was an arcade game or like Atari or something. It was like really, really young.
It was bad.
I think I remember seeing it at the arcade here, but I couldn't tell you anything about it.
The scene in the swamp where the Slayers come up out of the water, that was one of the main stages of the video game that I remember playing, and it was pretty much impossible. I don't think I ever got past it.
All the more swampy nostalgia, huh? You know, that's how I met the kid. He was in the Australian outback planting sacred trees that would grow together to make magic shrines, typically for like $20 and a hot meal. Man, I'm glad I got him out of that racket before it fell through.
I am too. Half the time the food was inedible.
I love.
He will betray you.
Comfort me for one night.
He will not.
I can't betray my bride.
Then he will die.
Let me comfort you.
I can't accept comfort when she has none.
You will not then.
I cannot.
My master said, make him betray, if not kill him. Yes, he is my master. These talons were a heartbeat away from your throat. I could have killed you in an instant. But in the hour I knew you, I loved you.
It is you who are betrayed. Power is fleeting. Love is eternal.
You said it, lady.
Is that a perfume commercial?
I think so. But the scent was overdubbed, so nobody knows. Let's see. I thought that whole, that whole seduction plot, you know, point was strange. You know, I love the fact that when he's talking to her, he's being faithful, but he's using words like she says you won't, and he's like, I can't. He's like, as if to say, he doesn't say I don't want to, or you know, that I you know what I mean? There's just something about it that feels very like I am restricted by other things. And since I am prohibited, there will be none of that right now. Go on with yourself, you silly goose. Okay.
If only you'd cut up to me after my wedding.
Right! I mean, what is the subtext here? Painful. Widow.
Your vision is your gift to me.
And your vision could be your gift to me.
What can I see for you?
The Black Fortress, where does it rise?
Tomorrow, in the Iron Desert, with
The knowledge is useless to you, for you cannot leave here. No man has ever escaped the web.
There is a young girl being held in the fortress. A young girl with your name. A young man seeks her. A young man. The age I was when you and I met. When you and I loved.
Love. L'amour. The spider effect was cool. The web was cool. Yeah. The web set was cool. The spider was, I mean, the spider looked cool, but then the spider was like, then they repeated the same footage like three times of the spider.
Yeah. And the
yeah.
It was a little choppy.
It was expensive.
The best I've ever seen. But I do have to say this. It's a good thing that the lady's name was Martha, or excuse me, Lissa, because otherwise this movie would have been over right there.
Right? bad comedy. Fire.
Glaive is gone. I have no way to fight him.
Corwin, it's not the Glaive, it's you.
Alyssa, it's us. It's us he can't defeat. He will not return to me except from the hand of the woman I choose as my wife.
I give it only to the man whom I choose as my husband. Take the fire from my hand.
I like the beast sound effect there too. He was really cool. He sounded cool. The sounds of the soldiers dying and dumping into the earth actually gave me nightmares when I was a kid. Way too freaky.
Did you happen to get the Wilhelm scream?
Oh no, where was it?
On the bridge when they were crossing the bridge and that one guy fell off.
Oh dude,
it was absolutely perfect Wilhelm scream.
Missed it. Oh dude, that's great. So that whole sequence there, I got to tell you, I had completely forgotten that part existed at all. Everything about the fire as a kid, I completely lost interest in this battle once the Glaive wasn't in the battle anymore. The Glaive was the cool part.
Yeah,
the Glaive was the cool part.
If you had
the
asked
fire
me
of love.
A few days before I watched this,
I
would have sworn that the Glaive is what killed the beast, because obviously that's the point of the whole movie.
I even
right?
remember the part where the Glaive gets stuck and won't come back to him. Like, oh yeah, he has to abandon the Glaive here, but the beast is dead. Oh wait, he's going over the little wall, so that's not the way it's going to work. Yeah, the whole fire love sequence, I completely, you know. Wow.
Also, though, I have to say, I kind of got the feeling, anyone else with me on this, that these two are the first people in the history of Krull to discover the fact that every married person ever becomes a badass pyromancer.
Right?
I don't think it's every... person on the planet. I think it's part of the royalty. I think it's a royalty thing.
Me too.
That's a really cool take, but where do you get that from? I didn't see anything in the movie to suggest that.
Well, nobody else
is just throwing fire around implies
I'm
that...
I'm assuming it just didn't occur to them. I mean,
we're not required to...
Desperation is the mother of invention,
We're not obligated to prove a negative here, you know what I'm saying?
Maybe the power was granted as part of the wedding ceremony... And because the wedding ceremony was interrupted, it was never removed.
Kind of.
Oh,
although they
check out Rich earning himself a no prize.
But they kind of completed the ceremony, though, at the end, really, right? I mean, that was kind of the way that felt. I'll give the fire out to you. Okay, now it's done. Okay, now I got some fire.
Yeah, but they didn't kiss.
Oh,
they didn't have to.
Yeah, not all weddings have to end.
The wedding's not done until they kiss.
Yeah,
it's a different planet.
But maybe the fire only lasts until the conjugal bed.
This is a universal truth.
It is a different planet.
It is universal truth, and people without lips can't get married. It is a fact.
No, it isn't. It is a fact on Earth.
Just
and only in
people
our
without
culture
lips can't get married.
It's not even like a worldwide thing. It's a cultural thing. You cannot pick this hill to die on, sir. It doesn't work.
I'm already on another hill running up dodging boulders.
I don't blame you. That last half
or I'm playing a different video game, I don't know.
Last 30 minutes of the movie were all action sequences. It was really hard to catch some of that, but plus the last, like after the beast dies, you know, I kept expecting to see a little clock, ticking clock show up in the corner, because that's how long you have when you're controlling the character to get out of the building at that point. It really felt like that.
Right.
So that was the one part of the thought. Make a great video game. We won.
Ugo!
He'll be all right.
You are his queen?
Yes.
Then we won.
Yes.
Oh, boy. I should have stuck to puppies. Oh.
I think it's time you unlock those manacles, huh?
Well, I thought I'd keep them as a memento of our journey.
Well, the key's yours.
Only the king and his Lord Marshal carry this key.
That's right.
Nice little callback. I got a thing. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Rich, what do you got?
All right. So on the down, when the show first started, actually, I probably should back up because I never got to say this earlier, but I had pretty much avoided this movie in the past. So I hadn't quite seen it. It was around. I knew what it was. I played the 2600 cartridge. I've seen the game on deck, you know, did the things in the game. I'm not good at games. So, you know, I was surrounded by it, but I never actually sat and watched the movie. So this was my first time through watching the movie. So everything to me, first brush, no nostalgia at all. So at the opening, when the ship came in, and you have this really large, really big ship, and you're showing all these pieces, I was fairly impressed with that. And then it landed, and then it did the whole phase out, phase in thing. That I was less impressed with. And then the interior of the ship, I know it was meant to be confusing and meant to be body-like, but I was always so confused as to how everything connected. And maybe that's what it was driving for, but it made it really hard to watch at certain points for me. But as far as outside of the castle, the journey, the traveling, the people meeting each other, the wonderful characters, I really enjoyed the different characters, their motives, and the fact that their threads were designed to cross and cut. And I love the story of the Cyclops. I love the story, how they brought everything in, and I thought there were some interesting takes, and I love the story. I love B-movies, and this was just a step up from a B-movie. If it had been done 10 years prior, it would have had a few less effects, looked a lot more clunky, and been exactly the same. And I appreciated all that part of it, but I thought the characters were well done. And I think that's the part I like about B-movies, is when the characters are interesting, I don't care how bad the sets are. But yes, I will agree, the costumes were amazing. And then the other thing that drove me nuts in this story was the whole, it's the thing about the glaive, right? I have a weapon. I get to use it once. And I guess that's what Obi-Wan said, or not Obi-Wan, the other guy said.
Ynir.
Yeah. When Colin was going to go up the hill, was to not use it. So it's like, here, you have to go up here, dodge these boulders, reach into the lava, pull out this weapon that apparently only you can pull out if you're lucky, and you only get to use it once, so don't use it. You'll know when you can use it. Ooh.
Yeah.
That means the movie's almost over.
We can only afford so many glaive shots is what it is, you know.
But the glaive was interesting, but yeah, it would have OP'd the rest of the movie, so I guess if I was running the game adventure, I'd probably say, oh yeah, if you use it early, bad things will happen to your party and you'll wipe. So don't use it until you know it's time to use it. And then as a GM, I'm sitting here going, okay, it's time to use it. because now I need you to use the OP because this boss will eat your lunch, which is kind of where they were at. So it's a grand adventure. If it weren't for the timing, because I think Princess Bride was way after this, it kind of feels like if you took the Princess Bride, took out the humor, most of the humor, took out the narration and unpolished it quite a bit, roughed it up, ran it through a blender and threw it on the table, this is what you'd get. Because it has all the high marks of the adventure. It's got all the different pieces. It's got all the different characters. Not presented in as fun a way.
I tried to follow you on that direction and I can't follow that one.
That's how I felt going through the castle at the end of the movie. Or when she was running through the castle the whole time and I had to watch her just run around. Anyway,
I felt more like Labyrinth than Princess Bride.
And not in a good way.
Right.
However you can feel like Labyrinth in a bad way, that was it. Which is not something I would normally say about Labyrinth. So, I don't know. It's hard because I very much love this style of Plotman movie. It's B-movie sci-fi period, even though it's polished up better from that. So I am rocking it out with 4.5 stars.
Nice.
I can't quite get to 5.
Wow. That's fascinating. Oh, man. I didn't expect to see any of that. That's cool. Vanessa, what do you think?
I'm glad I watched it. I should have watched it sooner.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that I could be down with that, yeah.
Enough. So, my thumbs down. Y'all are talking about the amazing costuming, and I still can't get over circus pants.
Thumbs down the pants.
That was a problem for me.
I am totally buying some now, and I'm going to wear them to work.
That's fine. But at least you're not going to be adventuring in them.
As long as I have a polo collar, they're okay with what I wear, as long as I'm wearing pants.
Fair. But no, like, every time I saw him, and it mattered, like, how the sun was hitting it or how lights were hitting it, since it was all mostly soundstage. When the lights would hit it differently, and then the stripes were just super vibrant, and I was just like, oh, cool, we're in the Big Top. And that's where my brain went. Every time. That was distracting for me. It distracted from the story. Really, as far as, like, scenery, the only part that I had a problem with was the fire mirrors with the green screen, because it was bad green screen. It was bad green screen. The fire bears were cool. The green screen was bad.
I was going to say, given the time this was filmed, it was probably actually a blue screen.
Either way.
Ever.
To be fair, it hasn't gotten a whole lot better. Independence Day also had bad green screen. So.
Whoa.
And the way that the girl character that I can't think of her name now, Lizette?
Lissa.
The way that she talked, the vernacular that she used, was so different from all of the other characters that it made her feel detached from everything.
She was from another kingdom, right?
Who knows what all the kingdoms the traitors were from? Just saying, they could have been from her kingdom.
As long as she doesn't have a British accent, we're okay.
Still, the way she talked was super different, and it bothered me. That being said, I still liked the story. So thumbs up, I liked the story. The rest of it, I was totally fine with. It didn't bother me enough to detract from joy in seeing parts of it. So overall, I would watch the movie again. But it gets 3.
3 stars. Jason?
The things that bothered me a lot.
How do you fall on this one?
On my sword, apparently.
Better than on somebody else's, I guess.
This was not the first time I've seen this movie, but it was the first time in recent memory. I was a child the last time, and the only thing that I remembered was the glaive.
Right.
I remembered the glaive.
I remember the glaive, the beast, and the fiery horses.
Nope, didn't remember the beast, didn't remember the fiery horses. I remembered the weapon. I recognized the weapon as a thing of pop culture reference and could pick it out of a lineup of fantasy swords and armaments.
Plot devices,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm glad to know that the princess was dubbed because there was something that felt off about every scene she was in, and now I know what it is. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but it was just off and distracting.
And to wit, I mean, the ADR was good enough that I didn't peg that as a thing until I read it in the trivia.
I thought it was the castle and not her voice, but yeah, I caught that now.
I thought it was her acting. Something with her acting was just kind of off, but when now, you know, knowing that it was a dub, it really kind of made sense. I would have loved to hear the original track, because I bet part of the problem that we're having, you know, that Vanessa mentioned too, with the fact that her always seemed, the cadence and everything always seemed wrong, she wasn't acting with everybody else. You know, there was nothing organic in that because it was all done, you know, after the fact. So, yeah, I think that's a thing.
Sound studio, yeah.
Right. So, I had a problem with the princess. I had a problem with the romance, you know, even though it was too political for me. But then they tried to make it about love. They tried to make this big thing about how they really actually loved each other. And I'm sorry, it was a political wedding. It was absolutely a political wedding. And, you know, it just, why are you making this big, we're going to die on the hill of love, when it was blatantly a political wedding? I'm all for saving the kingdom and doing the things and uniting the armies, but apparently that's not even necessary, because all it took was one guy and a band of misfits to go after the castle, most of whom died. And of course, most of the army of the first party died the night of the wedding. I think he was the only guy that left the castle alive, and that's just because they thought he was dead. So he didn't go back to his house and get his army, because who knows how many people died on the way there, because we talked about the Slayers controlling the roads and everything. Digging the glaive out of lava, having the fire powers mysteriously appear, all of these things, the band of misfits that decide to help him out of the goodness of their heart or whatever, it hurt. This movie hurt all over the place. And I'm trying to think of a positive.
Oh, you know, this was a fantasy, right? I mean, trope.
Yeah. The fantasy is that any of this would work.
Yeah. I mean,
the trees were planted nicely in the ground.
I dig all the impossible and, you know, illogical stuff. I don't know. And unlike Richard, I don't dig it because it's bad plot writing. I dig it because it's, you know, interesting. It's not normal. I'm not saying you're obviously.
I hate impossible stuff. To be plausible, at least. Some of the characters were kind of cool. I liked the Cyclops. I liked the wizard that you didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
He felt kind of Monty Python to me.
A little bit.
And yeah. I appreciated that kind of ode to humor.
I think Ergo should have been MVC. I like Ergo.
I am fine with that. I am fine with Ergo for MVC.
You guys are welcome to outvote me on that. I'm fine with that. I don't have a better recommendation.
Yeah, they're going to have to outvote me too, but...
who are you putting in?
Rel.
Rel, the Cyclops? No, I'm not. I wasn't real taken with him either, so.
But anyway.
I loved Rel.
Long story short, this movie was a long story that wasn't short.
You're not wrong.
And I give it 1.5 stars.
Wow. Ooh. Right into the basement. Jeez, dude.
We are really all over the place on this one.
To be
one,
fair,
we?
My rating when we went into this was a lot lower than it ended up being. The clips helped.
Cool. Okay. Kid, what do you got?
Well, I have to say that when I sat down to start watching this movie, I fully expected and was prepared to get to where I am right now and say that if it weren't for nostalgia, this movie wouldn't be getting anything out of me. But happily, that is not the case. There was some pretty heavy nostalgia involved, of course, because I loved this movie as a child, even though it turns out I didn't know a damn thing about it. I had no idea it had so good a story. I really didn't. For the first time ever, I was actually able to follow said story and understand what was going on and why, and that made a huge difference as it happened.
Agreed.
I'm going to kind of eschew the normal format, and without going into whether I'm saying thumbs up or thumbs down just yet, I want to talk about the Beast for a second, because I was extremely impressed with the portrayal of the Beast, and not in any of the obvious ways. I don't mean graphically or visually. I mean as a BBEG.
Yeah.
Because
he was a good one.
It didn't make sense to me, a lot of things, until I really put some thought into it. This guy has conquered countless planets. Countless worlds have fallen before him. No one has been able to stop him. And they shouldn't have been able to stop him here. And I think the real reason that he lost, the real reason he was finally defeated, was Inui. I think he had gotten so complacent and bored with conquering the galaxy, overconfident in his power, that he let the little guy slip through the cracks and take him down, and it shouldn't have happened, and it's his own damn fault he's dead. Because he had ridiculous power, ridiculous smarts, all kinds of tools and tricks and evil bad guy shit in his disposal. His thugs, his goons, the Slayers, were one of the most brilliant, endless rank of mooks I have ever seen. Because every time you kill one, its brain jumps out of its head, burrows into the ground, goes back, and climbs into a new Slayer. He literally had the ultimate limitless in green army. It was 100% renewable. I loved it. Oh, and real quick, when the castle is breaking up at the end, all the little sparks and glitter, my headcanon is those were the Slayers. Those were the brains of the Slayers making those little light bulbs, because otherwise I don't know how they could have ever gotten rid of all the Slayers. I think the magic just sucked them all up and they showed up as those little glimmering sparks.
And then they all went up into space because the castle fell upwards as it crumbled.
Right.
As castles
which
do.
Which was a cool effect. So I'm going to put all of that in my thumbs up category. Along with a couple of other things. Like I mentioned, I loved the Cyclops, except for the prosthetic. It was horrible. In fact, I distinctly remember as a child, that being one of the scariest things in the movie, was the weird half
top half of the Cyclops' head. But as it turns out, watching it on this viewing, I loved him. He was absolutely my favorite character.
Yeah.
With the possible exception of the puppy.
Yeah.
I also loved the Emerald Seer. I hated how he died in the swamp, killed by something he should have seen coming. He was a seer, for God's sake. In fact, that goes in my thumbs down category. He should have known that was... Anyway.
His emerald was broken.
A wizard should have known better.
Wizard should have known? No, you're right. The emerald was broken, but... Well, you're right. Okay, I'm gonna attract that, because he wouldn't have known to look into the journey, because he didn't know he was going to have to make a journey until after the emerald got broken, and he obviously didn't see that coming either, even though he warned them that his vision would be opposed. So, eh. His apprentice, the kid, I liked him. He was really cool, but ultimately an inconsequential character other than flavor. One of my other major thumbs downs is that the outlaws that joined him were completely pointless. The only thing I could think of that happened the entire movie after they joined that he actually needed them for was hurting the fire mares, because without enough people to do that, they could never have corralled them and caught them. Other than that, I don't think those guys ever did anything that made a difference other than the two guys that were still alive by the end, and of course dude's wife that brought them food. Most of them died stupid, pointless deaths, and they didn't really need to be there. If it had just been the leader of the outlaws and his one main guy, nothing in the movie would have changed. It would have ended the exact same way. Other than that, I have surprisingly few thumbs downs about this movie. Some of the special effects, especially the transformations, were clunkier than I would have liked, but I'm going to chalk that up to the date, and I won't detract on that count. The sets were spectacular. We touched on that earlier, but I especially paid attention to the Black Fortress when they were climbing it. Instead of just recycling one section of landscape like so many movies do, every shot that as we moved through that fight of them storming and trying to get inside, they actually built a huge portion of that for that, because you could see different features of the topography that they were using as the battle went on. That impressed me, because most people don't go to that much effort. I was really happy with that. The inside, how organic and smooth all of it was, the transitions and moving parts of the castle as they opened and closed around them. There was a waterfall inside that thing. So many little touches of detail that just made it feel alien, otherworldly, organic. The way parts of it looked like body parts, the eye that she was standing in, where the pupil was the tunnel that goes back in, the hands with the claws actually moving. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, so well done. I can't say enough how much I was impressed with the set design. If that guy didn't get some kind of award or recognition for his work, whoever organized and orchestrated all of the set designs in this, he deserved it. That was a masterful job. Final analysis, I have to give this thing, to my utter and complete surprise, 4.5 stars. It is a masterpiece of bad sci-fi. Oh, that was the other thing I was going to say. He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. The blend of magic, pseudo-technology, yes. Galactic civilization on a fantasy world, yes, where they know about other planets and stuff. All of that very much made me think of Eternia and the Masters of the Universe, which got more of a nostalgia vote for me because I love that. Yeah. And you just don't see it done. So, yeah.
Very good.
Thumbs up.
Very nice. All right. I'm actually going to fall in the 4.5 camp as well, to be honest. I would have loved to give this 5 stars going in because of all the nostalgia that it had for me, and I knew I was going to enjoy the hell out of it, and I did. But there was a lot of things that, especially in the acting, that really got to me. I already talked about that. So, where does that land us, Rich? What do we got?
So, I want to throw this in here real quick because this was a cute little story, but really didn't fit in with the rest of the topic. We got delayed in recording this, and so we were talking about, you know, needing to rewatch the film to make sure we knew what we're talking about again. And I was like, oh man, because I can't remember much of anything about the movie. I open it up on HBO Max is what it was on right now. And there's a picture of a glaive. There's the main guy, the main girl, the Cyclops, the Spider-Woman, and the other guy. And I'm like, oh, I remember the movie because it was all right there in those five right. pictures yeah, in yeah. the glaive. So it was an interesting little side note. And we're all like, yeah, that pretty much does pick up all the plot lines there real quick. It's a good
you don't need to watch the movie, just look at the movie poster.
Yeah, I got it. I'm back in the place. It was an interesting thing. The total that this comes up to, it averages out to 3.5 stars. So it makes it a good movie, not quite up to recommended overall, but 3 out of 5 people did push it past the recommended level. So take that as you will. If you like B movies and you haven't checked it out, you should.
I have mild regrets at raising my rating. Gotcha.
Well, Vanessa, what do we got for next week? Do we have that down?
Yeah, next week we've got Oz the Great and Powerful.
Oh, that'll be fun. We'd love to see where that one's at. Pull it up. Is it HBO as well? Is it Stars? I don't remember.
Stars.
James DeFranco and Mila Kunis. That'll be fun. All right, so make sure you watch that before next week and then join us for yet another episode of Exposition Street. Thank you very much for joining us today. Once again, if you want to drop us a line, feedback at prismaticsunami.com is the best way to do that. For Rich, for Vanessa, for Jason and the kid, I'm going to go ahead and get out of here. My name is Eric. Everybody have a fantastic week. We'll see you later. So, there's the music. I think it's the next one.